Please, the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Greg Mitchell. I'm here on behalf of the National Association of Business Trust, the liquidator, which is a state court insolvency proceeding. This matter concerns Section 523A4 discharge proceeding. This is an appeal by us, the liquidator, with regard to the overturning of findings of facts and conclusions in order of a bankruptcy court in Arizona, finding that the debt in question was non-dischargeable in the bankruptcy proceeding.
So your client is the Commissioner of Insurance for Kentucky who has been appointed as the liquidator, is that correct?
Yes, sir, that's correct, Your Honor. It's a state court insurance liquidation proceeding under state court insurance insolvency matters. The commissioner in that capacity acts as the liquidator as appointed by the statutory reference. It's a separate scheme outside of the bankruptcy code dealing specifically with insurers, and in this case even more so, which is how important this case is, is it's an unauthorized insurer.
Mr. Mitchell, if we can sort of get right to the heart of it here, the Franklin County Circuit Court made a factual finding that NBAT and NBA were one and the same entity.
Yes, sir.
I read that as being the alter ego, pierce the veil, whatever you want to call it. It's just one organization.
Yes,
is that right?
Yes, sir.
And then on top of that, we have the fact that Mr. Glogauer did not bother to comply with any of the insurance regulations of the state of Kentucky, so he wasn't even a legitimate insurance company when he opened for business.
That's correct.
Okay. So the question is, what is the effect of that factual finding on United States bankruptcy and district courts in the District of Arizona? Do they have to give full faith and credit to that factual finding as to the issue of being one and the same for purposes of assessing fiduciary obligations under ERISA? Have I got this right?
Yes, sir, absolutely. We believe absolutely, because in this case, and obviously it's a very difficult in the context of unauthorized insurers where they set up a third-party administrator and then you have a trust fund. In this case, it was a specific and express trust. The Franklin Circuit Court, following off the lines of federal court proceeding where the third-party administrator, Mr. Glogauer, had tried to say that state regulation didn't apply because of ERISA. So it's got a convoluted history. But once that was found, the Franklin Circuit Court determined that this was one entity. And to be the one entity, it was an unauthorized insurance multiple employer welfare arrangement subject to ERISA and therefore all of the fiduciary duties.
Who employed Mr. Glogauer?
Who employed Mr. Glogauer?
What entity employed him?
Well, prior to the determination that this was one and the same entity, he would have been the president, CEO, director, officer of national business, NBA, as they refer to it.
And who worked for NBAT?
No one, Your Honor.
How did it operate then if nobody worked for it?
Because it was all, as Judge Graham found in the Franklin Circuit Court order, and as Judge Baum found after trial on the 523A discharge, that NBAT was totally controlled and run by NBA, Mr. Glogauer.
This may be irrelevant, but I'm just interested in how your liquidation proceeding operates. Who are the claimants? You're obviously in the business of marshaling as many assets as you can, and then you're going to pay them out. Who are your claimants would be entitled to pay out?
In an insurance insolvency proceeding, most states have the model law, which Kentucky has. In that regard, the liquidator is supervised by one court in Kentucky. It's the Franklin Circuit Court, handles all liquidation matters. And in that regard, the liquidator has duties to collect the assets and to also, in this regard, to prosecute the claims not only on behalf of the entity of which they are liquidating, different from a bankruptcy proceeding, but also for all the claimants, creditors, and more importantly, the policyholders. The whole essence of
I should have been more specific in my question. I understand that in the abstract.
Yes,
who are the claimants in this proceeding, in this liquidation proceeding?
In which proceeding?
The liquidating proceeding that you're presiding over.
The claimants are the plan beneficiaries who had thought they had health insurance and their health insurance benefits were not paid. there were next to no creditors in the sense of a general creditor that didn't have their rent paid. So the primary claimants here, Your Honor, are the claimants that had a plan of what they thought was insurance for their health care, and as they found out, their claims were being held, and at the end of the day, millions of dollars of claims were not paid.
And is it turning out that they're on the hook for this, or is it the medical care providers that are suffering? Do we know this?
It runs the gamut, Your Honor, based on some other statutory provisions. In some cases, the providers have to step in. In most cases, it's the employees. I mean, there are, it's not in the record, but some very bad situations.
Isn't there a fund in the state of Kentucky to pay the claims when an insurance company goes out of business?
Had this entity have been set up as it should have been and properly regulated by the state insurance department, ERISA would apply, but only to the extent that the insurance laws didn't conflict with ERISA. The primary would be that you maintain reserves, which were to be actually justified so that the contributions being made would be sufficient to pay the benefits as they became due.
No. I understand all that. I'm following up on Judge Fletcher's question, and this is probably based on my experience here in California, but California has a fund that the state maintains through the Commissioner of Insurance so that when an insurance company goes bankrupt,
right, yes,
there are unpaid claims, money is paid out of that fund to make sure that the beneficiaries get their medical bills paid.
And I was trying to respond to a long way to get to the answer, which is because this entity was unauthorized, they were not subject to, in Kentucky, would be the Kentucky Insurance Guarantee Association.
So the claimants weren't paid out of that fund.
That's correct. Had this entity been set up and complied with applicable law, they would have become authorized. Therefore, then the guarantee fund would have attached, and had there been a failure, there would have been a fallback position with the Guarantee Association to pay the claims.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, Judge Nelson, sorry.
Sorry, Judge Fletcher. Go ahead.
No. I was going to make an extraneous and irrelevant comment.
Let's assume that NBAT and NBA are a single entity. Isn't the real issue whether or not the payments were made out of the trust funds? If we had, the liquidator had, 20% for administrative expenses, was that part of the trust? Are you claiming he was a fiduciary with respect to those administrative expenses as well as the other 80%?
Yes, ma'am. We claim that he was a fiduciary. Whether the order found that NBA and BAT were one and the same, but because they were one and the same, clearly all of those funds were trust funds of which he had a fiduciary responsibility. But given that there was still a distinction that caused much confusion of this separate agreement, nevertheless, NBA was, as a plan administrator and the plan supervisor under ERISA, had a fiduciary duty. Many cases find that you don't have to look simply to that, and Judge Baum and his findings found Mr. Glogar had sole control over that. So all of the funds would come into the NBAT account, of which then Mr. Glogar had the sole ability to determine when and whether to pay NBA, which then allowed him to pay himself.
So the funds that went to NBA was supposed to get 20%. I mean, that was the deal for their administration.
That was the agreement that was set between him and the executive director.
Is there any showing or finding in this case that NBA got more than 20%?
No, sir. There's no showing that they got more than 20%.
And is there any showing that the money that came to Mr. Glogar came from any other source than from NBA?
No, sir, I don't believe so.
What do you do then with what I think is we have a fairly strict definition under this dischargeability rule as to what constitutes the trust? And I'm following up on Judge Nelson's question, obviously.
I take it that the law, and obviously we've not found any case that's directly on point. Here, obviously, we have an unauthorized insurer with third-party administrator, which now has been determined by the court, the insolvency court, to be one and the same entity. To me, it's an express trust. And if you don't consider it to be an express trust under ERISA, many cases would find that it's a technical trust because ERISA says, and the findings would reflect, that NBA and Mr. Glogar had the discretion and controlled all of the aspects of the NBAT, the express trust. Therefore,
but is there any evidence that the claims account and the administrative account were not completely separate? Is there any evidence that they were not completely separate? This goes back to Judge Fletcher's, were they part of the trust?
Yes, ma'am.
They were completely separate, were they not? 20% was set aside?
From the record, it would be clear that the NBAT funds, all of the employees, the employers paid money. They went into the one general NBAT account for the Express Trust.
And so is there any evidence that these loan payments and bonus payments, which from my perspective were outrageous, but is there any evidence that they came from the claims account as opposed to the administrative account?
What Judge Baum found, Your Honor, would be that Mr. Glogower had the ability to control the movement of funds in whether you consider this one entity or two separate entities, the funds that came from these claimants, he had the sole ability and control when and where they were paid. Yes, it's true that the money, what do you want to call it, laundered, was funneled. It came through a separate account. He controlled paying of the check, went to another check under which he paid himself.
Go ahead, Judge Tom.
Isn't your theory that it doesn't matter that the money was split into two accounts? If they were one and the same entity, they could have had offshore accounts in the Bahamas or an account in a Swiss bank. Because of the fact that all the money came into one entity, that's the race of the ERISA trust. And whatever Mr. Glogower did with that money, he acted as an ERISA fiduciary, so that when he decided to pay the money to himself in the form of bonuses and loan payments, that was a breach of his duties as a fiduciary of the single entity ERISA trust.
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
Well, what happened to all that? I mean, why did this go bust? That is to say, what happened to the money that was supposed to be the 80% that NBAT was in control of and was supposed to then be using to pay out?
As Judge Johnstone in the Western District of Kentucky case found, as the Kentucky court Judge Graham found in 1995, as Judge Baum found, that from the beginning, notwithstanding what is in the plan agreement and the plan documents given to each of the claimants that thought they had health insurance, that this fund was supposed to be underwritten and the contributions to be based on sound actuary, just like an insurance company. That's what ERISA would require, notwithstanding those duties and obligations.
No, I got that part. I'm asking, what happened to all that 80% money?
This was a Ponzi scheme, Your Honor. It was cash flow. Simply, you paid your premium out, and based on that premium, they would pay the next person's claims until the money ran out. As Judge Baum, in his order and specific findings we put in our briefs, reflect, almost from the very beginning, there was a deficit because they did not establish reserves. It'd be you selling you insurance, and I simply take your premium, and I don't set any aside knowing that maybe next week you're going to go to the doctor's office and I'm going to have to pay a claim.
Was the underlying problem then that the premiums simply weren't high enough to sustain the level of payout required under the terms of the agreement?
Yes, sir. That would be one of the things, yes, sir, which the plan supervisor, NBA, was required
to. Is there any showing or finding of theft by Glogower?
No, sir. No.
So Ponzi scheme usually,
other than running it through those accounts, Your Honor.
Yeah, the Ponzi scheme usually is okay. I mean, a Ponzi scheme, but the guy running the Ponzi scheme takes a lot of money for himself.
Well, he paid himself $17 million over 3 years, did he not?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
That's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. It was quick.
And that $17 million was out of that so-called 20%?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I got it. Okay.
It grew quickly and it failed quickly, and we're dealing with the mess.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. You've got just a little bit of time. We'll make sure you
get just a response.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good morning. Kathy Sandweiss for Appley, Andrew Glogower. It's very tempting, and I see where the court is going on this. It is very tempting to want to hold my client liable because claims were unpaid, and we're talking about insurance companies, and we're talking about health care insurance. But
it's not us, counsel. It's ERISA. ERISA creates the highest form of fiduciary duty known to the law. And the question is, if this was a single entity and ERISA applies, then Mr. Glogauer had to conduct the business of this ERISA insurance fund in such a way that he did not engage in a defalcation. And the case law seems clear to me that where a trustee chooses to pay himself rather than the claims of the beneficiaries, he has defalcated under the law without regard to whether or not Mr. Glogauer is a good person, a bad person. He has breached a fiduciary duty, and the law holds him personally liable.
2 points.
What's wrong with my analysis?
2 points about that. This emphasis on one entity. One entity, one company can have two bank accounts, two pockets. We do this in law firms all the time.
But if you dip into the client trust fund, you got a problem. And the question is whether or not the two accounts constituted the race of the trust or whether it was just the 80%. And what do you do with the finding that it was all one and the same?
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. If there was any evidence that Mr. Glogauer dipped into the 80%, then we wouldn't be here now. But that's not the question.
But 100% of the money went into the NBAT, I'll call it the Express Trust Account, first. And Mr. Glogauer had to authorize payment out of that 100 cents on the dollar to 20 cents to go to NBA. And the question is, as an ERISA fiduciary, can he do that at a time when he knows that there's not enough money out of the 80% account to pay the outstanding claims that are pending but not payable because he doesn't have enough money to pay them?
Well, that was the party's agreement. The specific plan agreement provided for 80% to be paid for administrative expenses. There was no contingency plan for what if there wasn't going to be enough. That was the agreement. And if I would direct the court's attention to the
answer, simple. Let's just stick with the 80% account. If I am an ERISA fiduciary over that fund, and I know that there's not enough money in that account to pay outstanding claims, I can't use that money for any other purpose, can I?
The 80%, correct.
The 80%. I can't use it to pay the light bill. I can't use it to pay the landlord for the rent on my office space. I can't use it to pay my salary. I have to authorize payment for these claims. That's my fiduciary duty.
That's correct. And there's no evidence that the janitor or the light bulbs or the employees were paid out of the 80%. The evidence is absolutely clear that it was paid out of the 20%.
If he decides, knowing that situation exists, to pay the money over into the NBA account so that he can then pay the janitors, the light bill, and himself, why isn't that a breach of his fiduciary obligation?
That's not the standard. The Hemeter case really addresses this, and it's interesting because actually the Hemeter case is a Ninth Circuit case, and it actually says that holding simply that statutory ERISA fiduciaries qualify as fiduciaries under Section 523A4 does not end our inquiry. And that's because it's a two-step process. There has to be a trust rest as well as a fiduciary obligation. It's not a fiduciary obligation in the air. And this court and the Sixth Circuit have been very clear that fiduciary obligations are much more narrow under Section 523A4. There has to be a trust rest, and here's the important part that I think we haven't addressed today, and that's that the trust rest has to be pre-existing prior to any wrongdoing. And that's the Cantrell case. And that's important because what
pre-exist. It was established by the employers, and it was set up in, what was it, 1997 or 1998?
80%, 20%. That's right.
There's no dispute about the fact that the trust was created at that time.
the 80%, 20% was created, but the wrongdoing.
You say 80%. A trust was created, and in the trust documents, there is a provision that permits the payment of a 20%, I'll call it administrative fee, right? But the money still has to go into that trust before the administrative fee is paid out of it.
But then there's no one to administer the trust.
Well,
so,
the Franklin County Circuit Court found that there was certainly someone to administer it, and that happened to be the plan trustee, Mr. Glogower, one and the same person.
But that finding was made many years later. It was made after the payment was made to the 20% trust, and certainly long after these bonus and loan payments were made out of the 20% trust. There's no evidence of misappropriation of the funds in the 80%, and without a plan administrator,
it's not a misappropriation. Nobody's accusing Mr. Glogower of theft. He's accused of breach of his fiduciary duty. It's called a defalcation in the law, and that is not misappropriation or theft. It's simply an improper use of trust money to pay a non-claim use.
That's right. But the trust, the express trust, has to exist before the wrongdoing. And I know Your Honor is saying, but it did. The 80%, 20% existed. The 20% was always Mr. Glogower's money. It was never trust money. And so what we're trying to do here, what the liquidator is trying to do, and what the court is talking about doing, is imposing. There's some sense in the air of there was wrongdoing, the plan failed, there wasn't enough money to pay the claims out of the 80%.
Well, that in part is a breach of the fiduciary duty, is it not? The failure to properly underwrite the insurance risk so that you collect sufficient premiums from the employers to see to it that all of the anticipated claims will be paid. Mr. Glogower breached his fiduciary obligation in that regard as well, did he not?
That's not the standard, though, under Section 523. That may or may not be a standard of breach of fiduciary duty, and it may have been a breach under the unauthorized insurance laws. But remember, this is not a Kentucky state law case. We're just talking about the specific requirements under Section 523. And so whether or not there was a breach as to whether Mr. Glogower should or should not have asked the claimants for more money to be paid in higher premiums, maybe he should have. But that's not an issue that was tried in this case.
Well, one of the things that he didn't do was he didn't tell the trustees of the ERISA plan that there was not enough money to pay the claims. And that's another breach of fiduciary duty, is it not?
No. Your Honor, with all due respect, first of all, that issue was not preserved in the joint pretrial statement. And that's important because there was not evidence in the record as to that. Mr. Glogower was questioned, and the questioning went something like, isn't it true that you didn't notify the trustees? And Mr. Glogower responded, no, that's not true.
I thought he said, no, I don't know that wasn't done.
He said that in one part of the record as well, Your Honor. And so there's no evidence that he did or did not notify the trustees. What he did testify to was that at a particular meeting, he advised trustees to consult with their attorneys because he didn't have direct communications with them. But, see, this was not an issue that was fully developed at trial. There were the record shows that there would have been 500 boxes taken into custody by the Kentucky Department of Insurance, which either would or would not have potentially addressed that issue, but it wasn't an issue addressed at trial. And trial counsel objected vigorously to any expansion of issues beyond what was addressed in the joint pretrial statement. So the issue wasn't addressed. There wasn't evidence that Mr. Glogower did or did not specifically advise them. And
back to your 80-20 theory, is it your position that throughout the three-year course of the operation of this business that the NBA was entitled to 20% of the funds at every point in time throughout, even at that point in time, let's say 2 years into the operation, where Mr. Glogower clearly knew that there were an insufficient amount of money in the trust fund to pay the claims? We have that chart that was admitted as evidence showing the amount of checks that were written and the amount of checks that were held. and the amount of checks that were written is far larger than the amount that was held. So it looked to me like there were efforts being made to sort of float the beneficiary claim checks in order to meet the cash flow problems. Is it your position that even at that point in time it was okay for Mr. Glogower to authorize 20% be paid to NBA, knowing full well that there wasn't enough money?
I guess it's not my position that it was or wasn't appropriate, because, again, that goes back to sort of this general sense of what's a breach of fiduciary duty under common law, under ERISA. But we're only talking about what the Ninth Circuit and the Sixth Circuit has said is defalcation under Section 523.
But it seems to me what you've done is you've turned ERISA on its head. You have made the payment of the administrator for the administration of the plan the highest priority of the ERISA fiduciary, even if it means that the poor claimants who are trying to get their medical bills paid go without. And that cannot be ERISA fiduciary law. That just can't be the law.
But again, Your Honor, that's an ERISA fiduciary. And the Hemeter case says that holding ERISA fiduciaries qualifies fiduciaries does not end the inquiry. The definition of defalcation, and this is under Section 523A4 in the Hemeter case, the definition of defalcation includes both the misappropriation of trust funds held in fiduciary capacity and the failure to properly account for such funds. So, and then you combine that with the Cantrell case, which is also a Ninth Circuit case, that says that the existence of the trust funds, the trust rest, must exist before the wrongdoing. And so in this case, you've got this 20% that's carved out. That's the agreement of the parties.
And
the
it gets paid no matter what.
It gets paid. It's Mr. Glogower's money.
The 20% comes, even though the premiums are collected regularly over the three-year period, and even though Glogower knows there's not enough money in the race to pay the claims, NBA still gets its 20% first. And there's nothing wrong with that under 523A4.
That's correct. Otherwise, it would be asking this company to make a donation. I mean, theoretically,
let me ask you this. Over the period of this, characterized by your adversary, Ponzi scheme, what was Mr. Glogower's total salary during this period coming out of NBA?
I don't know that that's in the record, and there certainly is nothing in the record as to it being a quote-unquote Ponzi scheme. There's no finding of a Ponzi scheme, and I don't...
I'll retract calling it a Ponzi scheme. I made it clear I was using his word.
Right, and I did own. Hear Mr.
I'll call it a debacle, during this debacle.
How much
was Mr. Glogower paid in salary total?
I don't know that it's in the record, Your Honor, as to how much he was paid in total, but he had his salary deferred. Remember what these...
I understand that. I mean, that's what we're just dealing with, is payments of what purported to be deferred salary. How much, let me ask you this question then. Over the period of this debacle, how much did the 20% amount to?
I believe there's a record that it amounted to $11 million. But, you know, that's 20% of the total amount. And, again, it's not the standard whether or not Mr. Glogower did or did not take his 20%, because...
Yeah. Okay, now how many employees were in the NBA operation?
I believe there were about a half a dozen that testified in the trial.
And how long a period are we talking about for this? You're saying it's $11 million?
Right. Approximately a 6 or 8 year time period.
Okay, I'm seeing a shake of the head. You'll get a chance to say something about this. And Mr. Glogower is now in bankruptcy, correct?
Correct. This arose out of a bankruptcy. That's correct.
He's not in bankruptcy now?
Well, I mean, he... procedurally, the bankruptcy court denied the discharge as to the bonus payments and the loan payments, and granted a discharge as to the total amount of the unpaid claims. The district court then affirmed grant of discharge as to the unpaid claims and reversed as to the denial of discharge.
And that then finishes the bankruptcy?
Correct.
Assuming we leave it alone?
Correct.
Now, this is maybe outside the record.
Yes.
What do you do with all the money? Why is he in bankruptcy? That's a lot of money. And even though we don't know exactly how much he was paid, I'll tell you, federal judges get along on a lot less money than that, and we tend not to declare bankruptcy.
Lawyers get along on a lot less than that also, Your Honor. But I would just say that, you know, this court in the Sixth Circuit has adopted a very specific, narrow definition.
So either you don't know the answer or you don't want to tell me what he did with all the money?
I don't know what he did with the money. I'm not paid to know what clients do with the money.
Counsel, I'm looking at Judge Johnstone's memorandum opinion published at 770 F. Supp. At page, looks like, 1171. And he says, purportedly during the 32-month period in which it served as administrator / plan supervisor for NBAT, NBA received over $17 million in fees. So is it 17 rather than 11 million?
I'm sorry, where was that in the record?
That would be 770 F. Supp. At page 1171, Judge Johnstone from the Western District of Kentucky. In his memorandum decision and order in NBAT versus Morgan.
I see. If that's what Judge Johnstone said, then perhaps that is correct. But again,
so six employees, 32 months, $17 million in fees.
Maybe he paid a lot to his employees.
I want to be one of his employees if that's the case.
Well,
thank you, counsel.
Your time's up, but if you want to do a paragraph before you want to sum up, please feel free.
Yes, Your Honor. I would just say that this court in the Sixth Circuit has set a very specific standard as to what constitutes defalcation in a fiduciary capacity. That standard does require that there be an express trust rest and that any misappropriation of funds come out of that trust rest before there be deemed a non-dischargeability under Section 523, and that was not the standard that the bankruptcy judge applied. It was the correct standard applied by the district court judge, and I would ask that the court affirm the district court. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Mitchell?
The $11 million that was referred to was the amount of outstanding claims that were presented that have been unpaid.
I'm sorry, you're going to have to speak up a little bit.
I'm sorry. The $11 million that was just referred to, that was the amount presented of the outstanding claims that were presented to Judge Baum. Judge Baum specifically found that all contributions would be held in trust under the terms of the agreement. And you know, with respect to the defalcation, Judge Baum found that Glogauer decided to pay himself when he was fully aware that the entities, NBAT, NBA, he controlled, could not pay the claims due the plan beneficiaries.
Is there anything in the record from which we can determine whether, not whether these last payments were excessive under the circumstances, but rather whether 20% was an excessive amount to be paid for administration had this been a bona fide insurance scheme?
No, sir, that issue wasn't tried. Judge Baum, in his outline of the amount of claims and the amount of the 20% NBA received, is in Judge Baum's minute entry order, which lays out as the progression at the time these payments were made, that Glogauer continued to pay himself, notwithstanding that the claimants continued.
I understand that, but I'm the legal point that your adversary relies on, and that was the determinative legal point in the mind of the district judge here, however, is that NBA was entitled to this 20%, and that even though the 80% wasn't proving sufficient to pay off the claims, nonetheless, that was a separated fund. So I'm trying to figure out if there's some other way to skin this cat, which is why I ask whether the 20% was excessive, and we just don't know that answer.
That issue wasn't tried. What was is that all of the NBAT funds went into an account. And at that point in time, Mr. Glogauer had the ability to pay himself or not pay himself and use the 100% to pay the claimants, of which he chose all through that period when he had knowledge that the claimants weren't being paid and the money continued to accrue and he continued to hold checks. Judge Baum specifically found that
that he violated his fiduciary duty of disclosure when he failed to adequately inform the beneficiaries and the employees of the severe financial distress of NBA&T. That's the point, Your Honor. The fact that he was entitled to the 20% is an administrative fee.
And just to trace the money flow, so the money goes into the entire 100% goes to NBA&T.
Yes, sir.
And then NBA&T pays 20% to NBA?
But NBA controlled NBA&T and totally had the sole control of the access to the funds.
I just want to make sure I got it right, because you answered thinking I know more than I do.
Yes.
The payments come to, all of the payments come into NBA&T as an initial matter?
Which NBA&T was NBA. It was there physically. Yes, they had signature cards, but the signature cards for that account in the name of NBA&T were all people of NBA. They controlled that account. The money went in, but they controlled.
I understand. Yes. And I am. That's not my question.
Yes.
All of the initial premiums are paid to NBA&T, is that correct?
Yes.
And then NBA is paid by checks written on that account. That account is an NBA&T check?
Yes, sir.
Account?
Yes.
So that 20% comes out of, it always comes out of, the trust account?
Absolutely, yes, sir.
Okay.
And that's what we judge Baum said.
Right.
May I ask?
The money through.
I'd like to ask one question. I know the time is gone, but you have a very sympathetic case, in my opinion.
Thank you.
What do you do with the Ninth Circuit Hemeter case? The Hemeter case, which seems to say you need an express trust.
Yes, sir. We think Hemeter stands for the proposition that there is an express trust. Here, it's National Business Association Trust. It is an express trust. But as Hemeter found under ERISA, irrespective of where we were, a corporation or other, it's a technical trust of which NBA had fiduciary duties to that trust. So the res in this question is this NBA account, NBA&T account with 100% of the contributions that went into.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank both of you for your helpful argument. The case of Glogauer, In re Glogauer, is now submitted for decision.